studied this word sound because it comes up over and over here in this short book. The word is actually from the same root that we get our word hygiene. So it's very interesting. It has to do with being healthy or clean, hygienic. And then doctrine actually has to do with practical instruction. So sometimes we can think of what we may be tempted to do is think of sound doctrine as more of an informational theology type instruction that Paul's giving. It's basically practical instruction that leads to a healthy life. Welcome, Harvest family. This is John and Andrew coming to you. I'm excited about today's show. We're going to be talking through Titus chapter 1. John, we were supposed to do this last week, and then I got sick, so we postponed it. But better late than never. Excited to be working through this with you today.
Yeah, I think our listeners are ready too. You know, we just got a message like, hey, let's do this. You know, let's do this. So we've kind of built it up enough, I think. We're pretty excited about Titus. But God caught an audible last week and we rolled with it. But really look forward just to kind of walking through this with you, Andrew, but then also inviting our listeners. You know, even as we finish up this chapter one, we'd love for you just to kind of put in down in the comments, hey, well, what about this word or what about this theme? What are your thoughts on these particular elements of chapter one? We'd like to continue that conversation. So just so you know, we're excited, not just to talk, but also to interact with you and for you guys to interact with each other. It's a little overdue, but we're ready and hope you are too.
Yeah, that's one of the housekeeping notes that we wanted to touch on just before jumping into today's episode. And that is, we do have some listener questions that we're going to talk about today. So some of you have been asking those questions and sending those in. So we're going to work those into the conversation during the next 45 minutes or so. And so keep sending those in and we'll work them in. The other bit of housekeeping that I wanted to touch on, John, we've had several folks ask us where they can buy great Into the Harvest T-shirts like the one you're wearing, or coffee mugs or journals. So maybe just say quickly where folks can find that if they'd like to purchase those.
Yeah, there's a couple quick places, intotheharvest.org. You can just do the shop link right on our website. You'll see it come up. There's all kind of products right there on the website. Also, if you're kind of a YouTube extraordinaire and you follow a whole bunch of YouTubes, you're familiar with YouTube Shelf, but just right underneath this video, you'll see a listing of all of the different products that we have available. So on Spreadshop, you can kind of click on that mug or click on that t-shirt or click on that hoodie and do it right through YouTube. So either one of those places works, and we'll get you a merch that that you need or that you want. I guess you really need it, but maybe you do. I don't know. Merch that you want for Into the Harvest. So, yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to jump right into Titus chapter 1 on that note. Let's start at the start. Why did Paul write this letter to Titus? We talked about this a little bit in the overview, but why did he write to Titus, and what was Titus doing on the island of Crete? What was his mission? Chapter 1 really begins to reveal that to us, John. What do you see and what do you say about that?
Yeah, I mean, I love gifts like this when you're studying through the scriptures and you ask these questions. Why? Why does this letter exist? And he actually says, thankfully, in verse 5, this is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. So the mission is very clear from Paul to Titus. This is why I want you there. And he uses that phrase to put what remained into order. So for Crete, you know, for the people of Crete and for Titus, that mission is pretty clear. Stay there and put what remains into order. So I know you probably got some things to add to that, but put that phrase, setting what remains into order, is just full of all kinds of great things. There's some cool root words in there that will kind of throw you out on kind of this pretty cool journey to kind of figure out what's really going on with set what remains in order. So I'll kind of pass it back to you before I kind of go on my long diatribe on some of those words or whatever. I'm guessing we probably have some of the same thoughts. So,
yeah, Titus 1:5 was one of the central verses in the book for me because it does reveal the purpose and Titus's mission, but it also reveals why, what Paul is going to be writing about in this letter, because it's going to be related to this mission that Titus was there on the island of Crete to accomplish. So just to read it again, for this reason, I left you in Crete that you might set in order what remains and appoint elders in every city as I directed you. And as I studied the entire letter, I think you can really put all the other verses in the book under one of those two headings, like appointing elders in every city or setting in order what remains. So we're going to talk today, especially about appointing elders in every city, because chapter one, really most of chapter one, is about elders and spiritual leaders in the church. And then as we move into chapters two and three, we begin to see more of the set in order what remains, you know, what was the work that Titus himself was going to be doing. And, you know, it has a lot to do with promoting sound doctrine and then discipling God's people so that they are sound in the faith. And honestly, appointing elders in every city also has to do with how do we promote sound doctrine, because these leaders in these cities are going to be the ones who are taking the lead in teaching and defending sound doctrine, and also the ones who are going to be responsible for raising up believers in the church who are sound in the faith. So, verse five, very important. This is typical of Paul. When you study Paul's missionary journeys in the book of Acts, oftentimes he would travel with a team, sometimes just one other person, but typically more than one person would be with Paul as he went into a new city to preach the gospel and to start a church and to make disciples. And then often Paul would move on, either because he had to, like he was getting run out of town and his life was being threatened, or he was just moving on to the next place, and he would leave younger junior leaders like Titus behind to kind of tidy up and complete the work that was started. And I think that's what you see here in the letter to Titus, is that something like that had happened. We don't see this mission to Crete in the scriptures, like, you know, Paul and Titus visiting Crete and sharing the gospel is not in the book of Acts. And so we're kind of doing what is often described as mirror reading. Like we're looking at the text and we're back discovering reverse engineering, like, well, what was happening? It seems that this was one such situation where Paul and Titus went to the island, started a work. Paul moved on, but he left Titus to continue the work there.
Yeah, so good, Andrew. I think really Paul, as he describes himself, you know, we're talking about why did he write this letter, but you also have to think about the characters. You have to think about Paul and Titus and ask that question, why is this letter? So, you know, Paul describes himself in verse one, a servant of God and an apostle of Jesus Christ for the sake of the faith of God's elect and their knowledge and godliness. And he kind of goes on this kind of really long run-on sentence, which is very typical of Paul as you're trying to unpack all those things. But he describes himself as a bondservant, and he describes himself as an apostle. And just as I was thinking about that word apostle, it's a messenger who's sent forth with orders. You know, so when Paul knows that he is someone sent forth with orders and he's going from place to place, the very nature of the calling that he's received from God is go here, proclaim this message, go here, proclaim this message. But that isn't just where he stops. He's also making sure that what remains is set into order. So his job isn't just to go shout a message and roll out somewhere else and leave behind a whole bunch of people who don't have clarity on who God is and what God's about, who they are, what they're meant to do, how they're supposed to walk with Jesus. But instead, part of that job is he's actually making sure that the faith of God's elect, that the knowledge of the truth that's in accordance with godliness, that's right in step with godliness, and gives you this hope of eternal life, that those people in Crete are set in order, that what remains there is set in order. So just the why conversation ends up being a bigger conversation, because the very nature of who Paul is and the identity that God's given him is such a big deal.
Right. I'm actually reading a book right now called Journeys by Neil Cole. And going to be recording an interview conversation with him this week that will come out after we finish this series on Titus. But one of the insights, it's really a study of the life of Paul and specifically his four missionary journeys that you see in the book of Acts and how Paul grew as an apostle and his strategy changed and he became wiser in the way he went about things. Because if you read the first missionary journey of Paul, they really did kind of roll in, preach, and then roll back out very quickly. And what happened was the churches were very young, without leaders. They were easy targets for false teachers to come in. And that's why we get the letter to the Galatians, and Paul's trying to play catch up with just the very truth of who Jesus is and what the gospel is. And so as you study the journeys of Paul, he does become more strategic and purposeful about making sure to set in order what remains before he just moves on to the next place. And he had different ways of doing that, but one of them was to leave younger, mature leaders like Titus to do that. I think Paul's descriptions here on apostle and bondservant stood out to me. You know, if you think about how we tend to, you know, these are really our bona fides. You know, these are Paul's credentials. It's how he understood who he was, his identity. And I really saw these as both his posture, that he was a bondservant. He did not think of himself as this CEO, this Pope figure in the early church, but as a bondservant of God. And then apostle, I think, really describes the type of work that he was offering, that he was called to serve in, which was, like you say, to go into new places, spread the message, and start churches in places where Christ had not yet been named.
Yeah, so good. I mean, we really could spend all kinds of time just talking about those kind of identity statements. In fact, I think there's books written on just that word, bondservant. You know, you could go off, create a library on that one word, you know. But I do think that's important. And the same is true for Titus, right? So we're asking, why is it written? Paul has a mission and how he sees himself and the role that God's called him to. I think he also has a perspective on how he views Titus. And he describes Titus, a true child in a common faith. And those words, they matter too. So I've left you in Crete, this true child in a common faith, to set into order what remains. So those words matter to me. And so I just begin to ask the question, true child, why does he feel like he needs to say that? Or what's kind of at the core of that? And we've already established this, that 1 Timothy, Titus, and 2 Timothy in terms of the order. So I'm just thinking about, well, what's the context of Paul's life? What's going on with Titus? What's going on with Timothy even? And God, as I was just praying through and thinking through this, God gave me 2 Timothy 1:15. I'll read it for us. And hopefully this is a roundabout way to kind of get us back to that same question. Why does he say true child? So just give me 1 second. I want to pull it up so I don't destroy the verse here. But in 2 Timothy, the letter he writes directly after Titus, he says, "You are aware that all who are in Asia turned away from me, among whom are Phygellus and Hermogenes." That's 2 Timothy 1:15. So we don't know a whole lot about those two folks. We could really dive into that and try and track it down. But just for the sake of this, they did turn away, those two folks. And I think Timothy knows exactly who those people are. And I think maybe he even used in shock, like, hey, even these guys turned away. So this idea of genuine child or true child. So if you look up that word, it's genuine or sincere. And it really took me to, oh man, at the end of his life, he's seeing some of that work fade away. But he knows that Titus is a true child, a genuine, sincere child in a common faith. So that really informs verse 5 for me as well. So I don't know if you would have any thoughts on just the person of Titus and even kind of the words he uses to describe him.
Titus is he's an important figure in the New Testament. He's one of these next generation leaders that we begin to see while the New Testament scriptures are still being written. We see, of course, the original 12. We see Paul, people like Barnabas, but then you begin to see guys like Titus and Timothy, and those are some of the better known ones, but there are all kinds of other names that you see, like the two that you just referenced. I won't try to pronounce those names.
Just be confident. That's the freebie. Like anytime you read the Bible and you got a name you can't say, you just say it confidently and are like, whoa, man, they really know their Bible. That's for free, everybody. Yeah. Just say it confidently.
It's true. Yeah. That's true. Yeah, but you know, Titus, one of the ways that one of the other places in the New Testament that Titus shows up is in the letter of Paul to the Corinthians, the second letter we have in our Bible. And he describes Titus as his partner in ministry. And he also says that God was the one who had put into the heart of Titus the same genuine concern that he himself had, that Paul had. And so there's no question that Titus was very special in Paul's life, and that God had given them a unique connection. And of course, that was probably anywhere from 5 to 8 years before this letter was written. And so here we are, maybe 8 years later, Paul and Titus are still partnering. Now they're in a totally different part of the world, the Mediterranean world, mm-hmm. the island of Crete, but continuing to partner together to spread God's message and to help people come to faith in Jesus and walk with him and to build the church. So yeah, there was definitely a long-term relationship, special relationship between Paul and Titus. But let's shift gears, John. Let's talk about appoint elders in every city as I directed you, verse 5. Like I say, set in order what remains. Part of that was appointing elders, but part of that was also exhorting in sound doctrine. There were certain things that Paul wanted to make sure Titus was promoting while he was there on the island, which we'll get into in chapters 2 and 3. But let's talk about appoint elders in every city. You and I noticed that there's actually three words that Paul uses to describe leaders in the church here in the letter of Titus. Elders, of course, here in verse 5. Mm-hmm. But he also goes on to describe them as overseers and stewards in verse 7. So you've got these three words to describe spiritual leaders in the church that Titus was sent or left on the island of Crete to appoint: elders, overseers, stewards. So I know you and I have already talked about this a little bit, but do we see these as three distinct types of leaders, or are these three words describing the same leader, just different aspects of his character and calling?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because if you're thinking these are offices or distinct offices, you think, well, which one's an elder, which one's an overseer, and maybe they both just steward, or you kind of get stuck on all these words and you're trying to figure out, well, how does this work and what's my working concept of this? And so the words really help you. So if you're able to look back into the Greek and say, well, what's the word for elder, presbyteros, you know, then you look farther down. What's the word for overseer? That's the word episkopos, which is helpful. And then this third word, poimano. So I only mention that to say, well, can you clue me in? I'm looking to the Bible to clue me in on, does Paul use these the same way in other passages where there's three distinct roles, or do those words stand alone by themselves, where there's an overseer, this word presbyteros one time, episkopos is over here. But what I found is that Paul with Titus, and then as it's described in the book of Acts, which is a totally different offer, right? He uses those three words, and then Peter uses those three words as well. And so those three words, presbyteros, episkopos, and poimano, I'm probably butchering those, but we're saying them confidently so you think we know what we're talking about, right? So Titus chapter 1, verses 5 through 7, they're used. Acts chapter 20 and verse 17 and verse 28. And then 1 Peter 5, 1 and 2, those same words are used. And it's not always the noun version. Sometimes there's a noun version followed by an infinitive version. So in some ways you could kind of take those texts. This is how I would kind of describe those texts. In the Acts chapter 20, he says, elders were appointed overseers to steward. And then Peter would say it a little differently in 1 Peter 5, according to kind of how I studied it. Elders were to steward by exercising oversight. So we have those three words in Titus 1, 5 through 7, elder, overseer, and steward. But then you also see those exact same three words again in Acts 20. You see them again in 1 Peter 5, 1 and 2. So I believe it's one leader who's doing three things. He's appointed overseers to shepherd, and it's an elder. An elder was to shepherd by exercising oversight. So I wouldn't necessarily say they're like completely, totally interchangeable, but I think it's one leader who's got a couple distinct gift sets or skill sets that he's trying to shepherd with or steward with or oversee with. So clean up my mess there a little bit, Andrew, if I wasn't clear.
And it could be that these words, I agree that we're talking about one spiritual leader. So we're talking about spiritual leaders in the church, and Paul's using these three different words really to capture distinct dimensions of this spiritual leader. So on the one hand, you've got elder, and just by definition, one, this is a very biblical word. You have elders all throughout the scriptures. Typically, every town had elders. These were the wise, experienced, trustworthy men of the city that the city relied on for guidance and wisdom in times of crisis, the ability to settle disputes. So the concept of elder runs throughout the scriptures. It's not just a New Testament church concept, but as churches were formed, Paul and the other apostles, they use this same model of elders to provide leadership for the churches. And an elder, at its most basic level, an elder describes someone who has experience and proven character and abilities. So this is someone who he's got time in the saddle, and he's got proven time. Like he's lived his life before people in such a way that they can see his life and his character, his capabilities. And so that's really captured by the idea of elder. So elder has to do with proven character and competence, experience. Overseer, like you said, this really describes, I think, the chief work of spiritual leaders in the church. It's to oversee, or to maybe say it differently, to watch over. Mm-hmm. Same idea. So don't think of overseer as a title. Think of this as the type of work, to watch over the people of God who are in this city. So elders are these proven, experienced men of character and ability. And the work that they're doing is watching over. You see this in Acts 20:28. Guard, watch over the flock that the Holy Spirit has made you overseers. And Paul's talking to the elders at Ephesus in Acts 20. And then steward, I think steward gets to the point that I would say this is the attitude and the humility of spiritual leaders in the church, because a steward, maybe the most famous steward that you see, steward figure in the scriptures, is Joseph. So remember, Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt, and he goes through tough times as a slave and then later as a prisoner. But he has this amazing rags to riches story where he's elevated out of prison and he's made by Pharaoh steward. That's actually the word that you can see in Acts 7 when Stephen is talking about Joseph. He describes him as being made steward over Egypt by Pharaoh. And so what you see there is that, you know, Egypt belongs to Pharaoh. He's the ruler. He's the king. But what he has done is he's entrusted to Joseph the day in, day out management and running of affairs on his behalf. But Joseph, his authority comes from Pharaoh. He's operating in Pharaoh's interests. He doesn't have a mistaken view that all of this belongs to him. None of it belongs to him. All of it belongs to Pharaoh. And in the same way, stewards, spiritual leaders in the church, understand that the church belongs to Jesus. All of it is for him. They are simply managing his affairs and trying to bring him honor and to grow his interests on this earth. So I do think it's talking about the same spiritual leader. It's just describing his experience and his character, proven character, the type of work that he's doing, and then the spirit and the attitude of humility that he brings to his role within the body of Christ.
Yeah, so good, Andrew. And just to go back to Paul's dual statements about himself, bondservant and apostle. You know, you have this same thing. This elder has two distinct things that he's going to be doing. He's going to be watching over, and he's going to be God's steward for God's behalf. You know, so if sometimes we can think so distinctly about roles and putting people in positions that we actually can miss the point of those roles or those positions. And I think kind of diving into those words a little bit and kind of seeing how he interchanges and word plays those together really helps us gather, oh, this is the activity that that person is supposed to be engaging in, rather than there's a person we got to put into a slot and it doesn't matter what that activity is. So I think that's really important as we're reading the scriptures that, and we'll get into this when we talked about sound doctrine later, right? We're going to get into this idea of sound doctrine that's supposed to lead to the way we live. But the same thing has to be true here. The way he uses these words together is meant to draw us to the activity, not the position or the role, and not just a title that you put on someone's life. So.
It's one of the complaints I have from a few complaints I have with the New American Standard Bible. In 1 Timothy 3, there's a very well-known verse where it says, if any man aspires to be an overseer, he desires a noble task. The New American adds in the word office. So it says, I'm just reading here, New American says, it is a trustworthy statement. If any man aspires to the office of overseer, it is a fine work he desires to do. And I think adding in that word office obscures exactly what you're saying there, is that we're not aspiring to an office, or you shouldn't be. If you're thinking about leading in the church, you're not aspiring to an office, a position. I mean, I'm shocked, but I think NIV actually outperforms the New American in this verse. Let me read it. Let me read it in, this is the 1984 edition of the NIV. He says, here's a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. And I think that wording is truer to what we find in the scriptures, is that to be an overseer, in a sense, I hope folks listen to everything I'm saying here carefully. In a sense, all of us can oversee, all of us can watch over other believers, especially those who are younger than us in the faith. Now, in 1 Timothy 3 and here in Titus 1, Paul is specifically addressing leadership in the church that Titus is supposed to appoint. But the spirit of overseeing, or the work of overseeing, watching over, is something that all of us can and should be doing. And it's a noble work for anyone who's doing it. If you're taking the time to check in on a fellow believer and encourage them in their faith, or to rebuke them when they fall into sin, you're watching over your fellow believer. And that's a noble thing to do. So I think just to drive home what you were saying there, that this is not so much talking about positions or offices, although it's clear leadership that's being appointed here. So in some ways we may be splitting hairs, but the point that we're trying to say is that the emphasis is on the work and having a heart for that work and the qualifications for that work as a leader in the church. So yeah. Probably said enough about that. Let's dive into those qualifications.
You want some clarification on that? Dump it in the comments. I'm sure that kind of got you thinking a little bit. It's very clear he's appointing leaders. So please don't hear us say that's not what he's doing.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead.
Well, I suspect that the people that Titus ended up appointing as overseers were already overseeing. That's kind of another way to say it, is that they already were doing this work, and Titus is endorsing that and affirming it and making it clear that yes, these are the spiritual leaders of the church in this city. So he does talk about qualifications, and really there are character qualifications and your character qualifiers and disqualifiers that he talks about in verses 7 through 9. And then he also talks about competence. So some of the character traits and then some of the areas of competence that he talks about in verses 7 through 9. Any standout thoughts from you, John, from these verses about the qualities, the character qualities of overseers?
Yeah, you know, I think that most of the time, I just thinking about reading this passage. So when he says it, an overseer as God's stewards must be above reproach, you know, not arrogant or quick-tempered or drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable. So instead, hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, disciplined. You can almost like write those out on the list, and you know, you're thinking, well, our church needs leadership, and you know, check, check. Ooh, I don't know about that one. Check, you know, as you're kind of thinking through people. But I think we mentioned this when we did the overview, that Paul is writing Titus, but he's also writing Titus in such a way that Titus is going to read the letter and the whole community is going to see this letter together and hear it, maybe not see it, but hear it read to them as he's going through these characteristics. So as I think about those, the things that would disqualify, but then the things, you know, the negative things, to put it plainly, but then the positive things, I think as he's reading through that list, they're already thinking older, wiser people in our community. And then as he's reading this list, they're like, oh man, that's so-and-so. Like I'm already thinking in my mind who that is in my community, who I know is an elder that desires to watch over me and will steward me before God and will steward the kingdom work in our city, in our town, in our village, in our home. So I just think as we think about this list, which is very good, that I think it's meant to draw us to this place of, oh, I know who that is. That's this person. Like you said, they're already doing this, or we already look to these people. And what Paul is helping Titus do is to say, yes, listen to these people. And in some ways, he's saying, listen to these people, don't listen to those people, you know, which we'll get into here. But I mean, you just think about these things that are really easily would dismiss their message. If they're not above reproach, well, you would just dismiss everything that they would have to say or how they do things. Must not be arrogant or quick tempered. Who wants to listen to that person who's arrogant or quick tempered? A drunkard. Well, come on. Like, is he sober now or is he drunk? You know, so violent or greedy for gain. He's actually going to mention this greedy for gain again about kind of the people that are working against, the gospel message and walking with God's sound doctrine. So those things are really, you're like, oh yeah, duh. Like those are kind of duh moments. But then he moves into those very clear. These are the things you are looking for. You're looking that they don't have these things, but you are looking for this hospitable, lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined, you know, holding firm to the trustworthy word is taught. So, I mean, this sounds kind of crazy, but as I read through these, I'm like, well, these are kind of duh. These are kind of like, yeah, why wouldn't we want these to be true of the folks that are going to oversee and shepherd us before the Lord? So I think kind of writing them down really helps everybody realize these are key characteristics in order for someone to be a good steward and exercise oversight.
Yeah. What was the in verse 8 there? Could you read verse 8 again?
Yeah. Hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined.
Okay. Yeah. In the New American, it uses this word sensible. And I was trying to hear what the parallel word was in that. In the version that you're reading, the English edition that you're reading. But this word sensible comes up a lot. And so I was just curious. In the New American, it comes up in every demographic as we get into chapter 2 and we start looking at instructions for older men, older women, younger women. Sensible is just something that runs throughout. I wonder if it's the word upright there. But I agree. The verse that comes to my mind, John, with as you're describing these type of people, is from Hebrews chapter 13, where he says, "Remember your leaders, those who spoke the word of God to you, and considering the outcome of their way of life, imitate their faith." And that's really what we're seeing here in Titus chapter 1, is that the outcome of, you know, as you consider the outcome of their way of life. So these are people that if you looked at their life and they had these qualities and they didn't have the negative traits, it would be a life worth imitating. If, as a younger believer, you would say, well, that's how I would like my life to look when I get to be that person's age. And so, yes, these are qualifications, but they're also setting the tone and they're setting the example for younger believers to follow in their footsteps here. And then verse 9 really kind of talks about the core competencies, I guess you could say. Although, honestly, I think one of the core competencies is mentioned up in verse 6, where he says, if any man be above reproach, the husband of one wife, having children who believe, not accused of dissipation or rebellion. And, you know, one way to sort of encapsulate what's being described there is that, you know, this elder, this overseer, he's going to be entrusted with stewarding the household of God. And so you want to see, well, how does he manage his own affairs? And this is just a principle that we see Jesus teaching on, is that if you're not faithful in little things, who's going to entrust greater things to you? If you're not faithful in what belongs to you, then who's going to entrust you with their belongings or their interests? And so one of the competencies that leaders in the church need to have demonstrated is that they are able to lead their own homes well. Their wives, their children, their household affairs. And so this is something that everyone, you know, can be practicing in their younger adult years, is just managing your own life well. And especially for young Christian men, the call to be a godly husband, to be a godly father, and to be engaged in actively managing your household in a way that honors God and builds up your family. That is the training grounds for becoming someone who Jesus would entrust to actively manage his household and watch over his affairs. So the first core competency is just the ability to manage your household well. And then the second one is here in verse 9, holding fast the faithful word. What did you see in verse 9 there? Any thoughts from what it means to hold fast, or the faithful word, being able to refute and exhort?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. One of the thoughts I had was Jesus talking about anyone who's been trained. You know, someone who has been trained will bring forth treasure from the storehouse, old and new. You know, so I just, as I was thinking about holding firm to the trustworthy word as taught, it struck me back to, I'm constantly pulling from the treasure of what I've already been taught. In some ways, even resisting the urge for things that tickle the tickle the ears of others, you know, so holding fast to that trustworthy word is taught. But, you know, we've been kicking this around a lot. We're studying through the scriptures and kind of doing a big overview of the entire New Testament letters with our local church group here. And this trustworthy word is taught, you know, for us, that means, oh, I'm going to hold on to the Bible. I've got this written word, and anytime I've got anything that's going on in my life, I can just refer to this Bible. I'm going to pull out the text, and I can do the Bible to life and life to the Bible. But this is literally, okay, what did so-and-so say when they were in town? And how do I remember that in order to give it away and hold fast to that, rather than, oh, well, is this thing true that so-and-so is talking about? So this for us is a little harder to imagine, the kind of the pressure that I think kind of comes along with holding fast this trustworthy word, because they just couldn't pull it out, you know. Well, what's the last letter we received, or how do we do this? So, okay, no, when Paul said, hey, remember when he said this message, or can you? So I just think kind of having that perspective really helps us, okay, hold firm. And that actually helps us today, because there's so many people discrediting even the scriptures that we have. How do we hold fast to the word? So that, just some couple quick thoughts on that.
Great, because you're right. We don't really think about these elders in these cities on the island of Crete. Many of them may not have had access to the Old Testament scriptures. And even if they did, they might not have them in their own language. They might not even be able to read. So there are a lot of reasons why we need to imagine that they don't necessarily have easy access to the written scriptures, where they can just pull it out and thumb through it. And they certainly didn't have access to the New Testament letters. When Paul wrote this, it's probable that the Gospels had not even been written yet. So there were stories, oral stories, that were circulating about Jesus and his teachings, but probably did not have Mark, Luke, probably hadn't even been written yet. And they certainly didn't have copies of those letters or those gospels on the island of Crete, and probably didn't have very many of Paul's letters. So what they did have was the things that they had learned from Paul directly and the things that they were learning from Titus. So that's a great observation, John, that there has to be a humility and a desire to be taught by godly leaders and then faithfully hang on to that teaching and pass it on to the next generation. And of course, now we do have the blessing of having the scriptures, and we should cross-check all of that with God's written word. But I do think you're right that part of what he's describing here, these were leaders who had allowed themselves to be taught by Paul and Titus and were capable of holding on to that teaching, rebuking those who would undermine it, and also exhorting the younger believers to live up to the standard and the teaching that Paul and Titus were giving them.
Yeah, so good. And you mentioned this kind of listener question. I think this is the perfect placement for Simone's question. She says, in what ways is Titus a book about raising up disciples who make disciples? So I'm just going to push it right back to you, Andrew, because I think you're really touching on this question as you're walking through kind of, okay, what's it look like to hold fast to the word? And then obviously very clearly in chapter two, he's going to talk about older men, younger men, and that kind of passing it down. So I'll pass that question back to you. In what ways is this book about raising up disciples who make disciples?
Yeah, you really see it implied, implicit and explicit here in Titus. Implicitly, Titus himself was someone who had learned under Paul and now was capable of being left on the island of Crete. Paul had full confidence that Titus was going to be able to set in order what remains and to continue to promote sound doctrine for both these leaders that he was appointing in various cities, but also to the believers at large. And then the leaders themselves, they become this third generation, you know, Paul, Titus, and now Titus is instructing and appointing these elders in the various cities. And then these elders are going to be the primary leadership for continuing to raise up God's people so that they're sound in the faith, which is just another way of saying that they are faithfully living out the call of Jesus in their lives to be disciples. And then, like you said, in chapter two, we're going to see that those younger believers were called to share their faith and to evangelize and to be good examples, good witnesses for Jesus, whether that was in the family setting or if you were a bondservant, to be faithful as a follower of Jesus in a way that brought him honor. You know, even if you were one of the lower rungs of Roman society, you had a part to play in sharing the message and bringing honor to the Lord Jesus. So it's really woven all throughout this letter in Titus. What would you add or put in there, John, on this question from Simone?
Yeah, I think it's very hard for me to read the scriptures without that kind of bias. If the scriptures are about God the Father, him sending his son Jesus, that one is a foreshadowing of Jesus coming, one is looking back to Jesus' life on earth. It's hard to not see the entirety of scriptures from a Jesus lens. And much of what he did was made disciples who made disciples. And much like Titus here, Paul's given this mission to Titus to set up leaders. What rings in my mind is this quote from Robert Coleman's book, on the Master Plan of Evangelism. He says Jesus was not concerned about the masses. His concern instead was that leaders from whom the masses would follow. So you see this exact same strategy from Paul. In fact, I think the older that Paul gets, the more he actually aligned himself more clearly to the strategy of Jesus. And this being one of the last letters of Paul to write to Titus, I think we see the strategy very clear. So in what ways, I'd say almost in every way, as we're reading through here, setting in order what remains. Well, what happens? Well, there has to be leaders who can hold fast to the word because it's going to be attacked, and so that there's another generation who believes, and that generation can pass it on in such a way you're protecting something that has to be given away over and over again for generations to come. So I love this question because what it does, it helps us reset kind of the tone and understanding of the text. So I think that's very helpful. So,
yeah, Simone, thank you for submitting
great
that.
Question.
You know, even this idea, I don't know if you caught this, John, but when back up to verse 5, where Paul tells Titus to appoint elders in every city.
Yeah.
That stood out to me that, so obviously he's on the island of Crete. So there's an island wide mission that Titus is trying to fulfill. But when it comes to appointing these elders, these leaders, it's bounded by city. So if you were an elder in one city of a church in one city, you weren't an elder of a church in a different city. And I think this actually relates to Simone's question, which was, because I think it gets to scope, like how much can you actually oversee? How much can you really watch over the believers in a different city? And so in a similar way, I think when we think about making disciples, we need to be thinking local. We need to be thinking scope. You know, questions about like, well, who has God put in my area of oversight, like literally, not in a spiritual leadership sense, but in the sense of
actually see
whose life, and who can actually see my life. And it's just it's another good little, I think, insight into the mechanics of disciple making, is that it has to be localized. There has to be enough overlap in our lives that the younger believers can see the character of Christ in older believers, and the older believers can see what's going on. And probably a good transition into some of the challenges that Titus was facing here. And in the latter part of the chapter, there were these teachers who were upsetting the faith of entire households. And if you were in a city and you were an overseer, you would know that that was happening, and it was going to fall on you to address it. You know, not Paul, not Titus, not someone else. You know, you needed to be able to refute and silence those who were teaching things that upset the faith of believers in your church. So let's shift to that, John. What were some of your thoughts from that part of the chapter?
Yeah, I just felt like even I think he begins this transition in verse 9, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those contradict it. For there are many who are insubordinate, empty talkers, deceivers. They must be silenced. They're teaching for shameful gain what they ought not to teach. They're upsetting whole families. Then he describes that group of people, you know, that they're the Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply. They may be sound in the faith, you know, so this idea of sound is coming up and up again. But I actually think it finds its root back in that set in order what remains. And so that phrase set in order is another Greek word, epidiortho. And it's really interesting. That's where we get things like orthodontics or orthopedics. It's to straighten something. Straighten further is the root word of that ortho. And so if we can think about, okay, so it either is out of order, right? Or then nothing is set, so that you might put what remain into order. Like, so what's going on here? And he clues us in. What is he supposed to put into order? It's those who are upsetting sound doctrine. Those who are upsetting whole families. Those who want to teach in order to get money. So I just think that root word is really helpful, that ortho word, because it's to set straight something and so that it's set fast and it's quality. And just like you would put braces on your teeth to straighten them, or just like you'd put a cast on a broken limb so that it's straight and you can use it and it's ready for every good work. In fact, he says that word, right? They're not good for any good work. What's crazy is Paul is going to use that same root word to Timothy in 2 Timothy 2:15, one of the most famous passages for people who memorize the scriptures. And he says, you got that one? 2:15? You got it memorized?
Yes, I do. 2 Timothy 2:15 says, be diligent to present yourself approved to God as a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth, or handling accurately the word of truth.
Yeah, so that handling accurately or rightly dividing has that core word ortho. And it's almost like, hey, make your straightness straighter, or sharpen your straightness, you know, like how clear you are on the scripture. So I just think this idea, the role of this person, you know, the elder who oversees and stewards, is someone who's working on this idea of how do we brace up truth? How do we keep it straight? How do we keep it orderly? So Paul says that to Titus, and the answer there is leaders. He says this root word to Timothy, and the answer there is how they diligently handle the word. So when I think about those concepts together in this core word of what this elder, shepherd, overseer is supposed to do, it's he's kind of the braces, the left and right limits of how do we operate in the kingdom of God, that the elder is showing a right way to live, and the elder is also showing and holding up the right way to believe and think in our minds. In order those two things come together and they make a difference. And that's where then we're fit for any good work instead of unfit for any good work, which is the word he uses right in verse 16. All right. So that was a really long answer to set up kind of this conversation, but I want to give it back to you. Obviously I said a lot there, but I think that's such a core word.
You see these leaders, these leaders that are being appointed in every city in the church, they're holding fast the faithful word, which is in accordance with the teaching, but then they're going to work with that word as well. So they're holding fast, which I believe just means that they're staying true to what had been passed on to them, but then they're operating with that truth. They're leveraging it, they're deploying it. And you really see, you know, positively and negatively. So they're refuting those who contradict, they're silencing the empty talkers, the rebellious men, the deceivers. Part of how they were going to use that word, faithful word that they were holding fast, was to silence rebellious deceivers. But then they were also using that faithful word to exhort and to challenge the believers to grow up in the faith and to become sound in the faith. You see that, Titus was really up against some core challenges here. I would say that there are three things that stand out to me. One is he just was dealing with young believers and new churches. So that's a challenge just in and of itself. But then secondly, there were the presence of these rebellious men, these empty talkers who were upsetting entire families. And so part of his work was, okay, let's address those and let's appoint elders who can address these teachers who are undermining the church. And then the third challenge was he was working with some rough material, like the Cretans. The Cretans are described as liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. And then Paul's like, it's true. That's the kind of people you're working with, Titus. So you think about Titus is like, okay, so you're going to have to exhort them. You can't just hope that they get it, that they naturally become fully mature in their faith. No, you're going to have to exhort them, reprove them severely so that they can become sound in the faith. And so that's kind of encouraging to me, like, hey, whatever I'm up against right now, it's probably not as big of a challenge that Titus was facing here on Crete.
No doubt. Yeah. And the answer isn't to like just ease back and sit in and be like, well, we'll see what happens. You know, if God's given you a burden for the people around you, it's actually to, okay, how can I be faithful? How do I hold fast to the word myself? Is there some instruction that people don't understand? Those kind of things. We had in our notes this idea of sound in the faith or sound doctrine with good deeds, and how are those connected? I'd love for you to pull on that string a little bit, because I do think that when you don't have a written word as your standard, you're not just studying. What you do have is you'll know a tree by its fruit. So I think this idea of being sound in the faith and good deeds and that connection being so clear, like you mentioned in Hebrews 13:7, just one of the ways it clues us in on, okay, who do I listen to? Who do I give authority into my life? So I'd love for you to just talk about sound in the faith or sound doctrine and good deeds and that connection.
Yeah, and then we may have to land it on this one. So maybe I'll throw it back to you after this so that you can give us some final thoughts. But when I studied this word sound, because it comes up over and over here in this short book, the word is actually from the same root that we get our word hygiene. So it's very interesting. It has to do with being healthy or clean, hygienic. And so, and then doctrine actually has to do as more of an informational theology type instruction that Paul's giving, but it's actually it's basically practical instruction that leads to a healthy life or a healthy faith. So, what are the practical instruction? What is the practical instruction that believers need so that their lives can become more healthy, more clean? And that's really what it means to be sound in the faith as well, to have a healthy faith. And we get to a healthy faith by being exposed to practical instruction that leads to health, sound doctrine. And so that's really the connection, I think, between sound doctrine and then becoming sound in the faith. I saw a real contrast between the end of verse 13, where Paul is saying that, hey, reprove these young believers severely so that they may be sound in the faith, so that, like you said, that their lives actually match what they claim to believe. And I saw a contrast there with the end of verse 15, where it talks about people whose mind and conscience are defiled. And so, like, the opposite of being sound in the faith is to have a defiled conscience. I think that there's a parallel or a contrast that Paul is making there. And then he really hammers it home in verse 16, because he says they profess to know God, but by their deeds they deny him, being detestable and disobedient and worthless for any good deed. So sound in the faith does not just mean you can recite sound doctrine, that you can say the right theological affirmations, but it's that your life actually matches up with what you claim to believe. I really circled the two phrases here. It says they profess, they deny. I was like, wow, that's like really, and it's basically their mouths are professing, but their lives are denying. And sound in faith is when what you profess and how you live both show that you belong to Jesus. And so that's the connection between sound doctrine and becoming sound in the faith.
Yeah, I hate to keep referencing into 2 Timothy, but it's so thematic here between Titus and Timothy. And he says, yeah. He says to Timothy, he says, watch your life and doctrine closely. Watch the way you live. Watch the way you teach. They got to be married up. And he says, so that your progress may be evident at all, right? Is that 1 Timothy 4:15? I think you might need to check me. I'm pretty sure that's it. And so
yeah, when 4:15 and 16.
Yeah, I think that sound in the faith or sound doctrine, I think healthy teaching that leads to healthy living. And that what he does for us as he lists the qualifications of these elders is he says, watch the way these people live and receive instruction from them for how you ought to live. And if you just think about how this practically works in life, you're like, that person can do something that I can't do. I'm going to ask them how they do that. Or, wow, their kids act differently than my kids. Hey, how did you do that? You know, it's this teaching that leads to healthy living. Where, and conversely, what you see is, oh, well, those people are just trying to get ahead. They're just trying to make a buck. Oh, well, hey, they seem like they're really smart, but their whole life's a wreck. Like, so there's a real practical thing here, as you see, as you're reading through the text, that helps you see, okay, this is really where, I think where I land is we really don't need more knowledge. We need healthy teaching that leads to healthy living. Knowledge puffs up. It's really love that edifies. The 1 Corinthians 8:1 is kind of a universal principle here. You know, I think that what we really need is leaders. What Crete really need is we're leaders that were living out that sound doctrine, made teaching accessible to everyday people who were just trying to follow God in a faithful way in a pretty crazy environment, which you've already established, right? And so, you know, we've kind of talked about what, so what, it's really the now what. You know, so Crete is a lot like 2024, the world we live in. It's a very similar environment. You know, so if you think about yourself, if God has put you in this place and he's given you a community and you're trying to be faithful to the harvest and your nook and cranny of the harvest, What are you to set straight? What are you to put into order? How do you set left and right limits biblically and faithfulness before God? And then if you're growing up in your faith, who are you looking towards to help you set into order what remains, to kind of be that orthotic treatment, so to speak, that word ortho, who kind of keeps you straight? So, you know, we don't want to go all the way through Titus chapter one and just kind of like just leave you. But thinking through, what are some of the implications? How can you, if you're meant to be a leader, how can you better steward God's kingdom right in your nook and cranny where you live? Are you being faithful? Right. And then if you're someone who's growing up, who can you get under in order to grow so that you are fit for every good work? And we'll go on in Titus chapter two, obviously, about what that really looks like.
Right.
I was supposed to say spoiler alert earlier, but I didn't. Sorry about that. We'll get this word sound doctrine a couple more times right out of the gate in chapter two. So that'll give us a chance to kind of clean some of that, those thoughts up as well. But we really do just want you to fall in love with Jesus. We want you to fall in love with the scriptures and enjoy what God has for you. And for us to be able to look at what Paul had for Titus and figure out, well, what does that mean for me? He had a clear message for Titus, but what's that look like for me in 2024 in America, so far away from the island of Crete, total different kind of implications for life and technology and all these things that are different. But there really are some core principles here of what's it look like to have healthy teaching that leads to healthy living. Very practical ways to walk with Jesus in everyday life. So, look, we really have had a great time, but we're really looking forward more to you all jumping on, asking some questions. Feel free to poke at some things if you feel like we've missed some opportunities to talk about other things. I think we might have left a couple questions on the table, so maybe we'll throw those up in the comments also on the YouTube. But, Andrew, I'll let you close this down, but it's really been a great time just to walk through Titus chapter one with you all.
Yeah, thanks, John. I agree. John and I could talk for another hour probably, guys, but you probably wouldn't want to listen to that. We do have some resources that are included in the description of the show notes or here on YouTube under the video. Some free resources that will help you go deeper in the Bible. So check those out. And we'll be back again next week with Titus chapter 2.
Yeah, see you then.